Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. What does hope look like? How do we find and hold on to it in the midst of personal turmoil, communal suffering, global chaos, and the everyday challenges of being alive in this world? Bestselling author Anna Lamott's new book, Almost Everything, Notes on Hope, offers perspectives on forgiveness, generosity towards oneself and others, the ways joy can be a radical act, and how fear against all odds leads to community, to bravery, and right action, and these ultimately give us hope. Lamott is the author of the bestsellers Hallelujah Anyway, Small Victories, Traveling Mercies, and many others, plus the novels Imperfect Birds and Rosie. The new book is Almost Everything, Notes on Hope. It's a great pleasure to welcome Anne Lamott back to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here.
It's always a pleasure to have you on the program. What got you thinking specifically about hope?
Well, last year when I was traveling, last spring, everywhere I went, people were just freaked out and totally in despair, both about the politics and about the concerns about climate change and what kind of world our little ones are going to grow up into. And people just seemed flattened in a way I'd never seen at that level before. And when I was 61, I published a list of stuff at Facebook for my grandson and my niece, who's 15, my grandson's 9, about every single thing I think is true that I thought might give them kind of a playbook as they got older, and stuff that I wish that people had told me when I was young. And I think the truth gives us hope more than anything else. And so I hope that it was stuff like that all truth is paradox, you know, that light is waves and it's particles, and it's actually both at the same time. And if we look at it, we change it. And another thing I believe to be true is that everybody's sort of screwed up on the inside and anxious sometimes and worried and judgmental. And I wanted the kids to know that they shouldn't compare their insides to other people's outsides, because other people's outsides might look great, but if they got to know them, they'd find they were more like themselves than they would have guessed. And I wrote something about writing for younger people, but that actually is the exact same talk I give to grown-ups, but in different language. One of our young people in the family was really, really, really afraid of death, so I wanted to write something that gave them hope that I could promise it was nothing like they imagined. So this book sprang from that list.
You give an example in the prelude of the book of your own fear of jumping. And this is what many could think of as suicide or a suicidal thought, which you say you don't think of that way particularly. But you ultimately made a list with your psychiatrist about what you think of as you are in these high places, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had finally told my therapist 20 years ago that ever since I was a little girl at the skyscraper in San Francisco where we went to the dentist and really every very high place since, that something felt like it was trying to coax me out the window. I wrote about this in Rosie, which was my second novel, and gave her that affliction. And I have a number of diagnoses, but I don't actually have clinical depression. So it was odd because I didn't actually feel like killing myself. And then I would notice how often I'd be driving somewhere and just very idly think about turning the steering wheel towards an oncoming Mack truck. And so my therapist made me promise that whenever I was very high up, like on the Golden Gate Bridge where I lived near and anywhere, that I would say to whoever I was with that I was idly thinking about jumping, and that would break the trance. You know, the secret is what is so powerful and keeps us so sick. And so in almost everything I wrote about going to Cairo to give some sermons and a lecture, and I was way, way, way high up in this place called Garbage City with the minister who'd sent for me to come give these sermons. And I said, I promised my therapist that whenever I'm this high up, I'll mention that I'm thinking about jumping. And he just waved his hand in the air and said, oh, who doesn't? And I have never felt shy or self-conscious about it ever since, although I still mention it to people when I'm high up.
So it is the normalization in that case, the fact that that is a common human emotion to feel that way, that made you ultimately feel better.
Well, I think it's that we're all pretty much in the same boat. And that goes back to wanting to tell my grandson and niece not to compare their insides to other people's outsides, because I think on the inside, a lot of people would identify with thinking about driving into a tree going really fast, just because it's the common experience. The human condition is that it's hard here, and that even if your life has lots of beauty and love and connection in it, you're going to go through times that are just heartbreaking. You're going to lose a few people whose loss you can barely survive. It just comes with the territory of life. And so in my books, all these books, I never say stuff that seems intimate unless I know it's universal. And I think this is kind of universal, that people, especially that are sensitive, have found it kind of tough going sometimes here. And so, yeah, it's tiring. It's exhausting. And gravity always has its say. And we feel sort of heavy and lumpen and have that secret fear that everybody else got operating instructions in second grade, but that was the day you were out with chicken pox, and everybody else secretly knows what they're doing but you. So, but as soon as you share that, people go, oh, I thought that too.
You write in the book, in the second chapter, there is almost nothing outside you that will help in any kind of lasting way unless you were waiting for a donor organ. You can't buy, achieve, or date serenity. Peace of mind is an inside job, unrelated to fame, fortune, or whether your partner loves you. Horribly, what this means is that it is also an inside job for the few people you love most desperately in the world. We cannot arrange lasting safety or happiness for our most beloved people. They have to find their own ways, their own answers. It seems so simple, and yet that's a hard thing to come to, isn't it?
It is. It's really painful because most of us were raised to believe that there was something we could achieve or own or find a good marriage, or that there was just something that would mean that we got the FDA seal of approval, and after which we'd have great self-esteem and really be able to enjoy life and pay attention as it tromps around us, and we'd just be able to be present and in wonder instead of anxiety and ambition and whatnot. And I was raised to be a super achiever, which I dutifully became, and it didn't work. You know, it doesn't fill the Swiss cheese holes inside of us. And in fact, it can all just make it worse. And I wanted these kids and anyone who read the book to know that self-respect is really an inside job. I think that writers are more prone to this than anyone else, because you just grow up thinking that as soon as you got something published, you'd feel differently about yourself, you know, and that all your relatives who are saying, oh, you want to be a writer, well, that and 50 cents will get you a cup of coffee, because it used to be 50 cents, and now it's like $10, that and $10 will get you a cup of coffee. And or your parents think, oh, no, I dropped out of school to be a writer. And so you write something and the parents want to know if you found an agent yet, when you're actually just barely finding your way through establishing a habit of writing every day. So then I got published. And what most writers do is we start thinking about a much, much better, more illustrious place we could get published, but and that if we got published there, then we'd feel differently about ourselves and our parents, and our Aunt Eleanor would take us seriously as a writer. So then we get published in that place, and you're great for like several hours, and then you need to do it again, but it's someplace better. My son Sam has a website, a podcast site called HelloHumans.co, not com, because I think HelloHumans.com was taken. But he's done these amazing interviews with everyone from Gloria Allred to Frank Rich on how to be human, how to be fully human, Jack Kornfield. And he got to interview Paul Williams, the great composer and songwriter from Los Angeles. And Paul told Sam that the night that he won the Oscar for the movie, the Barbra Streisand movie, this is 30-some years ago, he won the Oscar. He stood in front of, you know, a billion people watching worldwide. And he said it bought him the whole rest of the evening. And by the next morning, it was gone. And he needed to do it again. And he needed to do it just as big. There's nothing bigger. So that is really a cautionary tale for anyone I talk to about how to write and why they should write, because it's not out there.
Anne Lamott is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the latest is Almost Everything, Notes on Hope. Do you feel to fully understand, appreciate, and recognize hope that we have to in our lives at some point have been at a place where we feel hopelessness?
I don't know. All I can say is that everybody I know or everybody that I'd be interested in sitting down next to at the dinner table has known hopelessness. I know I've been sober 32 years, and many of the people I know and both my brothers and have been practicing alcoholics and drug addicts, and no one knows hope or hopelessness or self-loathing better than we do. And most of the people I know who have a really rich spiritual life have known the dark night of the soul. And but I bet that there are lots of people who just have a very optimistic take on life, and they might be young enough that they haven't lost anyone who they couldn't survive without yet. There's also a long chapter on death, though, because by a certain age, somebody you adore will die. No one gets a pass on this. And after that happens, a whole world changes, especially if it was a somewhat younger person, because something has happened that just can't be. And it takes away whatever scaffolding you've been on all those years of thinking that if you do this and if you do well enough and if you're kind and if you get a Prius and you help pick up litter and you obey local ordinances, that everybody will be okay. But it doesn't work that way again. And so I think that when people say, wow, you've had a lot of people die in your life, I'm 64, and they say it with a little bit of anxiety about me or maybe standing too close to me, I feel like tick tock, tick tock, you know, it happens. Your very favorite uncle really will die, and he might die in his early 70s, which is way too young. And so if you haven't known hopelessness, it's very hard for me to imagine that you won't. I can say that having been through hopelessness a number of times, it was kind of nautilus for the soul. And you learn what really matters to you in life and who you can really count on and the aspects of yourself that you can really lean into when times are hard. And you know, you end up throwing stuff out of the airplane afterwards that just kept you flying too low. And you know that you better seize it, you better savor it, because our lives are precious, but they're pretty fleeting, you know. And when you're young, my son's 29 now, and I watch him. It's starting to change, but he and his friends were just spending their lives and squandering it all like drunken sailors, you know? And then they started to realize, God, they're going to be 30 next year. When I was a child, 30 was like, you know, Captain Kangaroo. It was white hair and wrinkles and a bad back.
You write in the book, the reason to draw close to death when we're younger is to practice finding and living in the soul. This grows our muscles for living. How so?
Well, I do. This one person in our family that was so frightened by the fear of death, the fear of her father's death or her sibling's death, coped with that by avoiding it as much as she could. So she didn't see movies where someone died, which is really where you learn so, so much about the precious community and the being surrounded by grace and by how the people who are there for the dying person are like white blood cells, or, you know, their buoyancy. They lift the person up and they can assure the person they'll never, ever be alone, no matter how scary their condition gets. And modern science has meant that I've never seen a death that was painful or terrifying. I've only seen deaths that I may have hated because I needed the person, but that were beautiful and that were gentle. So I advise this young woman to move towards it and to be with people she knew that were really sick, and to see the miracle of modern science and of people's really good natures and loyalty, and how people dig deep. They do the deep dive into themselves to be able to, both the person dying who needs to find the courage and the availability to just accept that they got a hand that means they're not going to live as long as they'd wanted. And the people that didn't run afraid from it, from contact with a dying person. When my dad got sick, I wrote about this in my first novel that was called Hard Laughter that came out in 1980. My dad had a metastasized melanoma in his brain, and he ended up eventually like a young child. And he'd been a brilliant intellectual and writer. People stopped visiting us because back then, he died in 79, people didn't talk about death. And people really didn't talk about death till the AIDS epidemic, when the dying community and those caring for them said, we are not going to pretend that this isn't happening, that it's devastating, that it's the end of the world, and that we are here. And that always made me, before the AIDS epidemic, I always was so afraid of death until my father got sick. And then I hated it. It really was like an atomic bomb fell on our family. I have two brothers. And yet, at the same time, I had never seen so much heroism and care, and hospice had just come around. I always tell people, once hospice arrives, it's like the cavalry, and every single thing you need to know and learn and find stamina from will be provided by the hospice people. But so in my experience, if you can stop running away from the reality, you can make friends with it. I said in this book that death is not the enemy, that snakes are, because I have a snake phobia. Oh, and cheese is, because if I start eating cheese, I can't stop. But death isn't. Death is as natural as childbirth.
I've told you this before, that whenever I read your books, I'm drawn back to them over and over and over again, because there is so much wisdom and beautiful thought there.
Thank you.
Paragraph I kept on coming back to, which I'd like to read, is it comes late in the book. If the earth is forgiveness school, family is your postdoctoral fellowship. Family is hard, 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 a crucible. Think Salem witch trials or Senator Joseph McCarthy and House Un-American Activities Committee. Great pain from which great transformation arises. The family is the crucible in which these strange entities called identities are formed, who we are and aren't, but agreed to be. Even in what might pass as a good family, every member is consigned a number of roles intended to keep the boat of the family afloat, which, because of the ship's rats, genetics, bad behavior, and mental illness, is not as easy as it sounds. It's the hardest work we do, forgiving our circumstances, our families, and ourselves. Parenting is hard, and so is old age, and every single teenager is hard. Even 12-year-old Jesus drove his folks crazy. And no word at all on the high school years, like Obama. Babies are hard, in-laws are hard, and forgiveness is hardest of all. What have you learned about forgiveness?
Oh, I've written entire chapters and parts of books about it, so I'm not sure that I can sum it up in a sentence or two. But
so let me ask you then about its relationship. What have you learned about forgiveness and its relationship to hope?
Well, I think that if we don't forgive, you know, I'm one of those Christians that just has a terrible time with forgiveness. I always say I'm reform. But I eventually forgive only because it's so toxic and awful not to. And it's like there's an old saying in recovery that resenting someone is like drinking rat poison and waiting for the rat to die. You're the one it makes crazy not to forgive. And that's why I mean that it's forgiveness school. The relationship to hope is that if you can do the forgiveness of your own mealy-mouthed, judgmental, overly ambitious self, anything's possible, because that is the hardest thing we do. We were so raised the opposite way, that, you know, hold yourself to the highest possible standard and, you know, clean up as you go and blah, blah, blah. But I've had some what I would actually call miracles with people who I just loathed, who had hurt me so deeply, and even worse than hurting me, had hurt my family or my child so deeply. And through saying it out loud and not keeping it a secret, I got the miracle. I would say it. There's three or four people to whom I'll tell anything. And I would tell one of them, and they would always say, oh, you know what? I know exactly what you're talking to. And then we'd talk about it, and I might cry because it's kind of shaming. And then we would end up laughing. And, you know, I just wrote at my Facebook page that laughter is holiness with its favorite feather boa on. And it's really what it feels like to forgive, as because you get your sense of humor, you get a little buoyancy back, and that's holy, that's sacred, and so when I'm talking to people and they haven't forgiven someone, I don't ever say, well, you really have to, if you want to have peace of mind, because peace of mind is an inside job, and not forgiving is like having undigested meat or something in your tummy, and you just need to be available for the digestion. And I don't do that, but I say, I know exactly what it feels like. These are some of the things I did. I pray for the person. I forgive myself for not forgiving them. I talk to God about it. I have a spiritual mentor that I write about in almost everything that is named Bonnie, but I call her Horrible Bonnie. She's been my mentor for 30 plus years because she believes totally in goodness and divine love, and that goodness and grace will prevail, and that I will forgive when I'm ready. And then she'll tell me a few of this action she took that helped her forgive people that had really hurt her family. And then I'll either do them right away or I'll do them when I'm good and ready.
Do you feel as though you'll ever be at a point where you can forgive the president, forgive what's happening in the world right now?
I do. And that's a miracle, because I am a little tenser than the average bear. But there's a whole chapter in this book on hope called Don't Let Them Get You to Hate Them.
Right.
That springs from something Booker T. Washington said 100 years ago or whenever, about how it damages your soul to hate someone. And then Martin Luther King takes it up and says famously that hate can't drive out hate, only love can, and says words to the effect of don't let them get you to hate them, because then you're toxic and you're discombobulated and you merge with them. You become fused with the person you hate. And I wrote this chapter on hate about a year ago when I realized, you know, in recovery, we say the willingness to change comes from the pain. And the pain of hating various people in Washington got to me. And I thought, I don't know how long I have to live, but I don't have long enough to feel like this for much longer. Then there's a little boy. I'll tell this quickly. I know we have to go, but there's a little boy in one of my Sunday school classes, an 8-year-old named Cooper, and I said to him, do you believe that God is goodness and grace and love and is always with you and will help you with any struggle you're going through? And he looked at me. He's just a beautiful child. And he said, about 40%. I thought, that's the best thing I've ever heard. And so I thought, what if I could, yeah, what if I could reduce my viral load by 40%? And I have. Yeah, and there's kind of an owner's manual in the book about how I went about that.
Well, it's a beautiful book. It's entitled Almost Everything, Notes on Hope. It is published by Riverhead and Lamont. It is always a great delight and always good for my soul to talk to you. And I thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much. I just loved every minute of this. Take care.
Great pleasure. Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.